couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films The Rhythm Section, Gretel and Hansel, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in his own words, and John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness as a retro review. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Very Bad Things, and my name is Maisha. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The pieces of news I want to hit are some remakes and sequels. You know, everyone always says that Hollywood has no original thoughts anymore. And at a certain point that's true. I do believe that's true. But you do have to go in the past. How many Blondie and Dagwood movies did we have in the 40s? How many Charlie Chan movies did we have in the 30s? How many Hopalong Cassidy movies did we have in the 30s? We had dozens of those. Hollywood and movies in general, because it's not just American Hollywood. You can go to Japan or Hong Kong or Italy or anywhere like that, and you have these movies that have been made over and over and over and over and over again. You always get remakes, reboots, sequels. Heck, there's a whole cottage industry of fake remakes, like Turkish Star Wars or something, where it just rips off something that's like in a Hollywood movie, and then they just make a country's own version of it that's not going to actually be distributed in the U.S. so it doesn't fight any sort of trademark problems. But there's always been a remake, reboot, re-sequel mentality in Hollywood and in everything. I mean, look at what happens on television. We have these movies like a movie like Fargo, which is a great movie. And then they say, we're going to make a TV show, Fargo, because we don't have any original ideas. But you know what, doggone it? That Fargo show is pretty good. I don't know if I would compare it in quality to the original movie. The original movie is so self-contained. But Fargo is a great series. And now you've also got things, and these irritate me because I'm not a huge musical theater person, but you every time I turn around, there's a musical based on some horror movie, The Reanimator the musical, Alien the musical, Heathers the musical, Carrie the musical, Young Frankenstein, the Broadway musical, Spamalot. I once interviewed Eric Idle right when the theater production of Spamalot was kicking off, and he had helped write the show. And I said to him, I go, do you think that if Spamalot does well as a theater performance that they might make a movie out of it? And he laughed. He chuckled. He's like, yeah, I guess that's what we do nowadays. Because you had, like, Hairspray the movie, which turned into the musical, which then turned into the movie of the musical. So this kind of stuff happens, but it always kind of makes me cringe. There's some remakes and sequel news this week. One of them is The Thing is getting, I guess, a remake in Universal. And you know, they did the prequel to The Thing back in 2011, which I thought was okay. I actually liked that movie. I can watch it in a contained space. It doesn't hamper the John Carpenter vision of the film. And also, I'll go back and I'll rewatch the Howard Hawks version of The Thing from Another World back from the 50s. That's a great little movie in and of itself as a throwaway sci-fi monster from space movie. But the only thing, I just hope that it's decent. I hope that it doesn't suck. And I hope that they dial back on the digital effects. Because if there's any real problem with the prequel to The Thing, it was using too much digital effects. I mean, it's such a masterful piece, the John Carpenter 1982 version, with all those practical effects, and not every single practical effects lands. There are some goofy practical effects in that movie. I'll fully admit that. But Rob Bottin's effects were so good at the time, groundbreaking in 1982, that they still look good in most of the sense. And there are times when you can use digital, but you don't have to do, you don't want to go big on digital. You want to enhance with digital. You want to help something out. You don't want digital being in the forefront. And I think that always a good mixture of digital and practical is a good thing. And that works. I'm all for that. And I hope that they just do it. Supposedly, this is based on the original novel that John W. Campbell wrote, which was an expanded version of Who Goes There, which was a novella. I think it's like 40 pages. And that story does burn through pretty quickly. And there's so many characters in that story. It's got like three times as many characters as the John Carpenter version. He scaled it down for the movie, but a lot of people bite it in the original Who Goes There novella. So I'm curious about this, but I'm not holding up hopes, but I'm also not, it's not going to ruin the 1982 version of the thing either. So, you know, live with that. Another piece of reboot, remake, resequeling. Lethal Weapon 5 is finally getting another go. We've been hearing this has been, in the works for 23 years, ever since Lethal Weapon 4 came out. And you've got apparently Danny Glover and Mel Gibson coming back with Richard Donner directing. I'm fine with that. Again, I don't think that the Lethal Weapon movies have been untouchable. They've been fun and they've been exciting. And I remember when the first one came out, it was very cool. But, you know, the second one, even, and then when you got to the third and the fourth, there were diminishing returns, but they were still enjoyable action movies. I don't think they were untouchable classics that you can't continue. And after Bad Boys for Life has done so well, with rebooting a franchise that's almost 20 years old, or, well, the franchise is more than 20 years old. I mean, Bad Boys came out, I think, the same year that the last Lethal Weapon movie came out. But those movies, you know, they're wanting to reboot that 90s action, and I'm okay with it. If they were getting too old for that in the 80s, God knows how old they are now. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit really quickly is a Super Bowl spot for Sonic the Hedgehog. I think it's just a cute little spot, so let's go ahead and play that. Of course, the movie opens on February 14th.
When it comes to speed, there's only one name.
I've studied the best spin moves. His? Legendary.
I race the fastest in the world. He makes us all look slow.
That dude, he knows it's all about the rings.
He's just a blur out there. What's this for again?
What's this for again?
What's this for again?
What's this for again?
Great question. I have no idea. But please, McCaffrey, go on about how amazing I am.
Now, of course, next week I will have a rundown of a bunch of the big movie trailers that ran during Super Bowl 54, and we'll be talking about that and some of the excitements. There's always dropping some surprises, so we'll be looking forward to that. Like last year, they had the Twilight Zone reboot got advertised. 2 years ago, they had the Cloverfield, 10 Cloverfield Lane dropping on Netflix later that night. So those are neat. I'll be curious to see what the other movies have to offer in next week after the Super Bowl hits. But, you know, Sonic the Hedgehog, I gotta say, this looks kind of fun. It looks like what Rocky and Bullwinkle probably should have been. Hopefully it's not annoying. It could be annoying, but hopefully it's not. And at least, hey, Sonic looks normal now. The other one I want to talk about is Irresistible, which opens on May 29th.
Democrats are getting their asses kicked.
We need some way to road test a more rural-friendly message.
If you can't live your principles in the bad times, I guess they aren't principles, they're just hobbies.
Colonel Jack Hastings is our key back into the great, now swing state of Wisconsin.
He just doesn't know it yet.
I am telling you guys, Jack could be the real deal. It's on here, boys. Game on.
I'm curious to see what Jon Stewart does with the movie, because he did that one movie, Rosewater, I think it was, about the guy who was being interrogated in Iran, but it wasn't a comedy. This one's a comedy. This one looks like it's going to be kind of funny, but it's an election year comedy about an election. The last time they did something like this was Our Brand is Crisis, which I actually kind of liked that movie quite a bit, and that thing flopped. The big problem with a movie like this is if it gets too real politically, because you can never please everybody with a political movie. And even this one, they're talking about, oh, the Democrats are this, because it's coming from the Democratic strategist's angle. So it's already kind of making the Democrats clearly the reasonable people and, you know, the Republicans. And I mean, Rose Byrne's playing a version of Kellyanne Conway. And I mean, that's kind of a caricature in itself. But they're trying to go over the top with it, but trying to also have like a sincere message, which I think Jon Stewart does have sincere messages. It looks like it might be funny, but I'm curious as whether he can strike that balance between messaging and just a realness to Americana and navigating the political divide. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the rhythm section and Gretel und Hansel. Yeah.
Thank you.
Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with the rhythm section. A woman who lost her family in a terrorist bombing goes on the warpath to seek revenge on the perpetrators.
I lost my family 3 years ago. I'll find the people who did this. I'll kill every last one of them. I need your help.
Stop. Don't panic. Be calm. Be still. You gotta get your rhythm section under control. And give your heart as the drums. Your breathing as the bass. That's the easy part.
What's the hard part?
Living with it.
Doesn't that sound like a cool movie? Doesn't that, I mean, that just sounds like a neat movie. I mean, we've seen it a dozen times before. But that sounds like a cool film. Yeah, somebody's going on the warpath. Get revenge. Yeah, it's not. It's not a good movie at all. First of all, the title's terrible. Here's how bad the title is. It's called The Rhythm Section because there's a scene in there, and they play it in the trailer. But there's a scene in there where Jude Law is training her how to shoot. And he's like, you got to get your rhythm section sorted. And he's like, your heartbeat's the drum and your breathing is this. And there's a certain truth to that. If anyone who's shot before, you actually have to be mindful of your breathing, especially if you're doing any sort of aiming, because just the movement of the body will change the trajectory of the bullet. So a lot of times you can hold your breath or exhale and fire. And that's something that marksmen and people who use firearms know. I don't know if anyone calls it the rhythm section, though. And then you make them. And then I watched this whole movie. I must have either dozed off, which has happened. That is the thing. I didn't even doze off in this movie. I watched every stupid frame of it. But I was, I think, so ready to check out. I was just sort of, my mind was wandering at that point when he actually says it in the movie. And even at the end of the film, I'm like, why is this movie called The Rhythm Section? It's a terrible name for a movie. You need a rhythm section. Oh, yeah, spy movie, terrorist revenge, that kind of thing. But that's the kind of misguided focus that this movie has. Blake Lively's character, literally the first 30 minutes to 45 minutes, is just her moping and moping and moping. Yes, I know, I'm sorry, your family, your whole family got killed, and you blame yourself because they switched the flight, and you didn't meet them at the airport, or whatever. But, seriously, the entire opening credit sequence is her moping about a flashback to her family. And it's so overdone and so cheesy and so cliche. And we've seen this kind of thing before. I'm just like, I get it. I get it. She's in grieving. And then she goes from being a heroin addicted prostitute to suddenly detoxing and learning how to become this amazing assassin that can go over to international places. I mean, people train for years to do the spy thing. You don't just take some marksman course with some guy in the middle of Scotland and maybe jog a couple miles to learn how. It takes years. I mean, even like a character like James Bond, yeah, he's sort of cavalier about stuff, but the character, he spent years as a commander in the British Naval Forces, and you know, he worked as a spy, and he's an expert at all these different things. She barely even knows how to walk in some scenes. Yet somehow she's brilliant and amazing. And anytime she fails at her job, it's so cliche because she's, it's too hard to deal with. Maybe I can't kill somebody, even though she's killed 10 people before. I mean, it just, the film itself is, it's just boring. That's honestly, it commits the worst sin. It's an action movie with no action in it at all. There's like one car chase scene. There's a couple fight scenes, but pretty much it's just her moping around. And the character, it's bad.
It sucks.
It is indicative. Here's the thing. This is the way Super Bowl weekend is. Hollywood understands the culture of America in a lot of ways. And they understand that the Super Bowl is a huge day. If you ever want to sort of carve out the days, you, of course, have the big holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas and 4th of July. But Super Bowl Sunday's like a national holiday because everybody is kind of doing the same thing, or at least focused on the same thing. You don't even have to be a football fan to like the Super Bowl. There are people who spend all day Super Bowl Sunday preparing for the party just so they can eat the food, drink the beer, and watch the commercials, and they don't give a crap about the game. I don't even know who's in it. Who's in the Super Bowl? Is it the Mud Hens or something? I don't know. I don't follow the Super Bowl at all. But I will watch the commercials. I will, you know, if I ever have an opportunity to go have some nachos and drink somebody else's beer, absolutely, I will do that. So the entire Sunday is kind of lost. It's one of the most least performing Sundays on the calendar. I mean, along with like Labor Day is a notoriously terrible time for movies. The movies don't do well on Labor Day. So Super Bowl Sunday and Labor Day weekend, those are just notoriously low performing days for movies. So they don't release anything big. They don't want to do a tentpole or a big exciting movie. And that's why you get stuff like The Rhythm Section or this next one we're going to be talking about. Gretel und Hansel. Yeah. This dark retelling of a classic fairy tale sees two kids get captured by a witch in the woods. Yeah.
Look. It smells of cake.
Careful with that, dear. I'd hate for you to start something you can't stop.
Please make your acquaintance. I'm called Gretel, and this rough one here is my brother Hansel.
There's something wrong here.
But it's so pleasant.
Where are all the animals?
This is essentially, it's a retelling of the grim fairy tale of Hansel and Gretel. But it's Gretel und Hansel first, because I think it's focusing on the female character, the sister, more. And she's played by, and I don't know the girl's name, but it's the girl who was in the in It. She played Beverly, the young Beverly in It, the Jessica Chastain's character as a kid. And this is meant to be a horror movie. It's been a rough month because we're really just capping off of January. It's been a rough time in 2020 for mainstream horror. I mean, you started out with stuff like The Grudge, and what was it, last week or the week before, we had The Turning, which flopped. And the ones that I've seen, I mean, like I said, The Grudge was terrible. Underwater was kind of a non-starter. And now you've got Gretel und Hansel. And that one is, I don't know, there's nothing about it that really intrigues me. It's one of those that I'd be like, and it's also PG-13. So I know that the directors have been out there defending the PG-13 rating, but it's got Alex Krieg as the witch. And I think she's great as a creepy character, but they didn't screen it. I had to go see, I could choose one movie to go see and pay for. And that was The Rhythm Section. I think I don't know whether I dodged a bullet or whether both of them were bullets. But Gretel and Hansel looks, it doesn't look impressive. It doesn't look interesting. It doesn't look like it's actually scary. It looks like it's one of those movies that's shot with atmosphere and creepy lighting, but actually doesn't evoke fear. It's just more a design setting. Anyways, it wasn't screened, so it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about another movie that's new this week, which is Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in his own words. It's in limited release. And, of course, a retro review of John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the other reviews for the week. This first one is a limited release movie. I imagine it's only in a small number of theaters. I don't actually have theater counts for this, but I imagine if you have a theater in town that plays a lot of limited release stuff or independent films or anything like that, or if you have one that's particularly politically minded, I would imagine leaning on the conservative side, considering the subject matter, you may want to check this one out. You can find it in theaters, but if it's not in your local town, you may just have to wait. It might make its way through, or it just might find its way on demand very soon, and with a DVD release as well. And that movie is Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in his own words. The very private Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas gives a long-form interview for this documentary about his life
and career.
When I was six, I wandered the streets by myself. You were hungry and didn't know when you'd eat. Someplace in my life, the road split off. I'd gone to the seminary. I'd gone to all white schools. I was never going to be a part of that world. I was never going to be white. The problem is I can never go back completely to the world I came from.
That I will nominate Judge Clarence Thomas to serve as Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court.
That's when all heck broke loose.
First of all, just to let you know how this movie is structured, you remember that movie De Palma that came out 3-4 years ago? And it was literally just, it was from A24, and it was literally just De Palma, Brian De Palma, sitting in an interview setting, just a camera on him, talking about all of his movies. And then they cut to his movies, and it wasn't other people. It was just De Palma talking about it. And this structure of documentary is very popular among people who want to see something about a very specific figure and want their take on things. So this is mostly, I mean, the majority of this movie is Clarence Thomas just talking about himself. I mean, he's there on screen talking about everything from his early life in Georgia to the Supreme Court hearings, to even what happens afterwards, you know, in the years that followed, because, you know, those Supreme Court hearings were, what, 30 years ago? So if you are looking for an expose on Clarence Thomas, you're not going to get this on this one. You know, for those on the left that are looking for something pulling back the wool to show what a dastardly person Clarence Thomas is, you're not going to get that. This is not that kind of movie. I mean, it's not even like, you know, if you take on either side of the aisle, a Michael Moore or Dinesh D'Souza movie, which are very partisan. This isn't even really partisan. I mean, you can, I guess you can sort of tell they're coming from the angle from the right aisle, because, I mean, it's giving his own words. It's not questioning any, there's nobody in there asking hard-hitting questions and following up, because it's a profile of him. It's based on his autobiography. And so if you want to hear more about Clarence Thomas and how he became who he is, you're going to get that in this movie. And I find that interesting because it does go back. Most people only know about Clarence Thomas from like 1990 on. But it goes back to his history about his days when he was a kid and how his family life and his upbringing affected his politics of the day and how his politics changed over the years and his experiences going through school and going through college and law school and then some of his career paths getting involved in government. That part's kind of boring, that middle part. I found the most interesting stuff was his life going all the way up through about college or law school, because that shows how he formed who he was and how he formed his opinions as an adult and as eventually as a justice. All that stuff in the middle where he's like in the EEOC and he worked for Reagan and Bush, and that was just that's just kind of boring. That's behind the scenes political stuff. And then of course it gets interesting again during his Supreme Court hearings and then the Anita Hill stuff. It does get a little silly, because here's the thing, you know, and that it's interesting to watch this Anita Hill kerfuffle with today's lens, because you've got all these different stuff to unpack. First of all, you've got the fact that Joe Biden is presiding over this, and Ted Kennedy is one of the main people grilling him. And you do kind of have to roll your eyes, because, you know, Biden's, I think, got some history with peccadillos, and certainly Ted Kennedy has. And these guys are questioning him whether he was talking about inappropriate jokes in the office place rather than running women off a bridge and letting them drown. You know, that kind of stuff. So the absurdity of that is even more absurd now. But it also, in the light of sort of the Me Too movement, you do look at it and sit there and say, I don't know if I totally believe this guy either. And then part of it is because then they go back to interviews with him and his wife. His wife gets interviewed as well. And it's like, oh, I knew the second she mentioned pornography, because I don't do pornography at all. And I don't have an unclean thought. I am just I read the Bible, and that's all. And I'm like, come on, man. All guys look at pornography. So it does get a little bit of, he protests a little too much, even when he's sort of downplaying stuff. It's like he talks about his first marriage, and at one point he's like, they ask him what happened in the marriage. And he's like, well, I don't know. No, nobody really knows. It just, you know, things happen, and then you get divorced. And I'm like, no, I've known many of people who've gotten divorced. Everybody I know who's gotten divorced knows exactly why they got divorced. So I think there is a certain amount of, you know, him glossing over certain facts in his life to make himself look better. But, you know, ultimately you get this look at Clarence Thomas. It does run a bit long. It's a bit long-winded because he tends to be a little long-winded. But like I said, if you're a fan of Clarence Thomas or you want to see how he ticks, this is a good look behind the curtain. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next one. And this is a retro review. And that is John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness. A group of theoretical physics grad students embark on a study that might find the existence of the ultimate evil.
What is it?
A secret that can no longer be kept. It started a month ago.
What started?
A change in the earth and the sky. His power.
There's a weird locking mechanism. Looks like it can only be opened from the inside.
A life form is growing out of prebiotic fluid. It's not winding down into disorder. It's self-organizing.
Even on today's show, I've talked about John Carpenter. I mean, I was talking about The Thing, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. I considered it to be probably John Carpenter's best movie, but in a close second, even before Halloween, close second is Prince of Darkness. The reason Prince of Darkness is on, I consider one of his best movies, is how well constructed it is. It's not accessible to the mainstream. It's really in the weeds when it comes to a horror movie, but it's really well done. Because it's basically supposing that there is this entity that is the ultimate evil, and it's trying to break out so it can bring its father, you know, the full-on Satan, back from another dimension. I mean, it's dealing with Cthulhu mythos level of ideas wedged into Catholicism at the same time. And it does a great mixing of that nether region within religion and philosophy and theoretical physics that seem to all align. And that's the neat stuff. It also has a great cast. Victor Wong playing one of the professors. You got Donald Sutherland playing the priest. It takes you by surprise, and it's unnerving and it's disturbing because it actually makes sense. If you can kind of, usually on a monster movie or a religious movie or there's a certain level of disbelief you have to get through and you have to push past that. In this one, the threshold's not very big. It's not steeped in the 80s the way some of these horror films from back then were. It's effective. It's John Carpenter at his best, doing his headiest work. I mean, if you thought In the Mouth of Madness was a little goofy and weird, this thing goes way beyond it. And it's fantastic. Just don't actually watch the trailer, because the trailer has spoilers all over it. This is one of his lesser known movies, but it's still one of the best John Carpenter movies that he ever made. I remember seeing it in the theater in 1987, I guess was when it came out. And I loved it. I've loved it from the minute I saw it. And I go back and revisit it periodically. That's why I'm talking about it now. I had revisited it. I got the Blu-ray, revisited it last week, and absolutely loved it again. So that's worth checking out. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Very Bad Things. And my name is Maisha. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's look at the box office for last week, because we're going to be going into, right now we're going into Super Bowl weekend. And as I said, most people, they stay at home in Super Bowl weekend. They are not necessarily on Friday or Saturday, but they stay at home on Sunday because everybody, or they go out to somebody else's house, but they're not watching movies. Last weekend was not a bad weekend, but it wasn't a great weekend. I mean, the Gentleman was the big opener of that weekend. It only came in number four with $10.5 million. Bad Boys for Life came in first with $34 million, bringing its gross to over $100 million, $120 million going into the week. 1917 is still holding strong with, you know, drops of less than 30%. So it was about 16 million last weekend, and Doolittle's still doing okay. I mean, for a movie that got very much maligned and is getting raked over the coals, it made $12 million and brought its total to 44, which isn't great considering the price tag on the movie, and hopefully the international box office will save it. I thought Doolittle was a perfectly fine, charming little movie. The Turning came in at number 6 with just under $7 million. And I guess that's okay considering these movies always have such a low cost about them. But it goes to show you that there's a lot of these movies that are just kind of coming out and flopping in January right now. I think Blumhouse might have burned off a lot of its good juju in terms of the way the release weekends have happened over the years. Like, I've talked about this before, where tentpoles are no longer just summertime and Thanksgiving, Christmas. You're seeing tentpoles in March and even February and April with Fast and Furious movies or the Marvel movies. You're seeing tentpoles showing up in September sometimes. You're seeing tentpoles show up in January when you have a big movie like American Sniper come out as a wide release and do extremely well. So the time of the best performing movies being in the summer and the winter aren't always the case. They're not always the case for holiday and summer movies. So I think they might have to start rethinking the standard tradition of releasing horror movies, just crappy horror movies, in January, which has kind of been going on for about 15 or 20 years. Of course, this week, probably the Bad Boys for Life is probably going to win again this week. And I can't imagine the rhythm section or Hansel and Gretel doing much better than anything else. They might come in third or fourth or fifth. Who knows? It just depends on how poorly they do. I don't think Hollywood's expecting much from them at all. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The first release I want to talk about is Very Bad Things from Shout Factory. Peter Berg's directorial debut tells the story of a bachelor party in Las Vegas that goes horribly wrong.
The best man.
It's 5 guys, $900.
The stripper's here.
Excellent.
This is Tina.
The problem.
A slip.
I think she's dead.
There are always options.
You left a dead prostitute in the desert?
It's a 105-pound problem.
Can't do this. You've already done this.
And that worked.
It has worked.
It is working.
What have we done?
What have we done?
What did you do?
Have you done this before?
Bam! I just turned your little kid.
I am not canceling this fight.
I don't want you to.
I want to know what happened in Vegas.
Nothing happened.
Nothing happened in Vegas.
This is a movie that has a counterpart. There's a movie called Stag, which I believe was a Showtime movie. And it had a very similar story about a stripper that gets killed in a bachelor party. That one's even darker and more grim and unappealing than this one. The thing with the Very Bad Things, I remember when this came out, it was supposed to be punchy and fun. It was supposed to be a dark comedy. But when you watch it, I don't see the comedy to it. And here's the thing. I like a good dark comedy. Fargo, I mentioned Fargo earlier in the show about something totally different. But Fargo, that's a great dark comedy. It's dark and it has very comedic moments. I said that about The Gentlemen last weekend. That movie has a lot of moments where you laugh, but what you're laughing at is something you probably should feel bad about. I get the dark comedy. What I don't like about Very Bad Things is I think all the comedy comes from a negative source. Not that it's dark, but it's kind of like Very Bad Things feels like it's the comedy for people who laughed at the handicapped kid in school. You know, that's the kind of comedy it feels like, because it's mean-spirited comedy. Because otherwise, it's just, you're just like, these people are unpleasant. I don't see things actually funny about what's going on. And I mean, I guess maybe I'm missing the boat on this. But Very Bad Things has a great cast and some real up-and-comers. You know, you had Jon Favreau in it. And Christian Slater was kind of at the top of his game. Cameron Diaz as well. Like Daniel Stern. And of course, you had Jeremy Piven in it as well. There's a lot of big names in this. And I think it could work. But, I mean, none of the characters are appealing. Even like the pretty bride, Cameron Diaz, she's a bridezilla. And I don't know if that's meant to be a bad thing. Or it's just like, well, this is the way women are at their weddings. It just is not an appealing movie. And I think the only one who treats it like a comedy is Christian Slater. And even then, I think he's just having fun because he was happy to get the work at this point. The special features on this are okay. I mean, they got some, they've got a new audio commentary on there with the hosts of Critically Acclaimed, the podcast, Whitney Seibold and William Bibbiani. There's also actor interviews with Jeremy Piven and Daniel Stern, plus the theatrical trailer. So nothing a whole lot. This is mining all that sort of the fringe movies from the 90s that were released in theaters, but really kind of felt like more of a direct to video type thing. So, but I'm still going to have to say that Very Bad Things kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next piece of the Home Cinema Roundup I want to spotlight is My Name is Maisha. This film takes a look at what leads up to the shooting of a young black woman by police in 1998.
Worst come to worst, my people, my...
The entrance to gunshot number one.
Ever have one of those dreams where nothing comes out when you try to scream? Just so you know, this ain't gonna be one of them feel-good shows.
This is, even though it's a contemporary movie, it came out, I think it hit the festival circuit about 2 years ago. This movie is nostalgic for the 90s because it takes place in 1998, which predates the huge rise in awareness of shootings, police shootings of African-American individuals. I guess you could probably say the modern, what's in our sort of zeitgeist right now, the modern era of that kind of started with Michael Brown. Maybe you could say the Trayvon Martin, even though that really wasn't an officer that was involved, but the shooting of black people by people of authority and acquittals happening. But this one goes back to the 90s where it was mildly pointed out. That was more of a time where we were looking at Rodney King style police brutality. That's what was in, I think, the zeitgeist back then, to use that term twice. I mean, the movie itself is, it's more of a profile of this girl and just her life. And I think that's the interesting part of it, kind of what leads up to the shooting. And it's not based on a true story. I realize that blurb made it sound like it was based on a true story, but it's inspired by other stories. I think it kind of amalgamates them all together, which of things that happen. But when you watch this, you do wonder, this doesn't seem as cut and dried as something like the Philando Castile shooting or the Sandra Bland incident, where you can look at this and say, well, that was clearly a violation of that person's rights. There was a lot of confusion in something like this. And I think it brings up some issues there, but it also plays like a nostalgia for the 90s. But it also puts the situation in such a way that you're like, I could see where something could go awry here. So I don't know. I mean, this is much more of an art piece. This is more of a mosaic to watch rather than a narrative film. And I think that's how you have to frame it if you're going to enjoy it. It was not my cup of tea, but I understand that that's kind of what they were going for in this movie. So if you're looking for something like that kind of gives a different perspective on what it was like to be in this world at this time, in these neighborhoods and of this color, I think that it's a relevant way to check it out. So this is available in digital. You can probably also find it in theaters. I think it's released in theaters just last week, very limited, but it's also available on streaming as well. My Name is Maisha. I'm going to say it kind of rocks, not because I particularly liked it, but I think it's an interesting framework.
It kind of rocks.
Also available on DVD and Blu-ray include Terminator Dark Fate, Motherless Brooklyn, Parasite, and Ballers Season 5. And that is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Birds of Prey. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.